The central act of religious community reveals the bonds that bind each to all. The connectedness discovered within the particulars of our own lives and the lives of others encourages reverence. Once felt, it inspires us to act for justice. Unitarian Universalism assures us our struggle for justice occurs as members of a larger community. The essential vision of the progressive community enlarges and strengthens our capacity to hope and to help where despair, neglect, abandonment, damaged children, teenagers, young adults, adults, and seniors. Together, we renew our capacity to care and allow love all the room it needs to pay attention to our world and to the good work of creating a world where equality is there for all. Good morning. I am Michael Nelson, who is privileged to serve this Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan, Kansas. Whether you were born into a small or large family with plenty of love to go around, or not enough at all, you are welcome here. Whether your mother lived or lives a life filled with purpose, or felt or feels oppressed by a lack of equal opportunity to flourish, you are welcome here. Whether your grandmothers were immigrants barely able to speak English, or who were well educated and could articulate perfectly what they felt and needed, you are welcome here. Whoever you are, whatever gifts you bring, whomever you love, you are welcome here at this fellowship of hope and good work. I extend a warm welcome to our visitors and guests. If you feel comfortable finding out more about what it means to be a member of this wonderful place, please talk to me. And where's Shirley? Shirley Hopper, oh, she's probably running around getting things done. But she's got a red coat on. You'll recognize Shirley because she'll recognize you. I call your attention, let's see here.
First woman to serve in a president's council or cabinet was Frances Perkins. She was picked by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt to be his Secretary of Labor in 1933. She met toe-to-toe with the labor leaders of the day, which included AFL, Mr. Green, Carpenters Union, Mr. Big Williams, Bill Hutchison, United Miners Workers, John L. Lewis, a lot of you will recognize that name, and of course the Teamster Union, Dan Tobin. You get the picture, white men, head of the union with only white male members. But they were hurting because the union-busting tactics of business were making a headway. Does this sound familiar? She was very concerned at the height of the Depression with the conditions of the workers. Thanks to her, we have today the 8-hour workday, the Social Security system, unemployment compensation, and child labor laws. Many of these were being challenged today. She was FDR's moral conscience. Frances said her grandmother taught her a long time ago that if anyone opens a door, one should always go through. Lily? We light the chalice today in honor of all the women who walked through when someone opened a door, and to those who will have the courage in the future to walk through that door that is open to them.
call your attention to the announcements that are in our order of service. And in addition to those, I would like to share these. Michaela Sievers would like to invite everyone to enjoy Wamego High School's performance of Disney's Beauty and the Beast next weekend. Performances are Friday and Saturday night at 7:30 and Sunday at 3. And if anybody has walked through the Ina's LSAP room, you will notice that the apron that went in front of the proscenium stage is now gone, and we have lots of room there. We would like to thank Christopher Banner, Miliz Mata, Terry France, and of course Mark Mosier for helping. We need people, Mark says, with pickups to remove the debris that you'll notice at the back door. So please help if you can. Now's the time when we take a moment to honor all that happens in our lives that brings joy, brings a cause for rejoicing, or those moments which cause us to close our eyes with deep concern. If you have a personal joy or a deep concern that affects you personally, please share that now. Is there anybody who would like to do so?
Anna Franklin. I have a personal joy this morning just in coming in here. I've seen so many beautiful and bright children. We have so many wonderful people in this group, but we also have so many bright, beautiful children, and I'm so grateful for that.
Jim Chanteau, I wanted especially to follow up on this, the comment of the children. It was very nice yesterday afternoon when the children prepared a Valentine's treat for all of those of us who live out at Meadowlark and others who came as well. So I found it really, really pleasant to have so many young kids running around a place where most of us have kind of a lot of gray hair, or some don't have any hair at all, I guess.
Corey.
I'm Kathleen Oldfather, have joys and concerns. Concern first is Franz Samuelson, husband of Phoebe Samuelson, had a stent put in this week and is now recovering at Bramlage at Meadowlark. If you'd like to send him a card or stop by. Another joy, our friends Susan Adamchek and John Heritage are here today visiting, and Susan's going to speak. And it's Michael Oldfather's birthday today.
Also, I wanted to say it's Charles Darwin's birthday, is it not?
Things do evolve.
We have two darling children who tend to get a lot of ear infections. So 2 weeks ago, Owen had tubes put in. Yes. Mm-hmm. And happily to report that his ears are now clear of fluid, and he has restored hearing in both ears. But Sloane has to have tubes put in this Thursday. So have her in her thoughts. It's a fast procedure, but it's hard on us and the kids. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
So in that spirit, why don't we now sing the hymn that was before
we have
pastoral
one
care.
Michael.
Oh, we have another one? Sorry.
I have two brothers.
All right, there we go.
That's a concern.
Let us sing hymn number 131, Love Will Guide Us, and stand if you like, or sit if it feels better.
Thank you.
Amy Hogendorf, Katie Kingery Page, Tom Page, Esther, and Stephen Simmons, please come forward. This morning, we welcome all of you into the life of our community as new members who have chosen to make a commitment to this congregation by signing our membership book. New members, I'm over here. Your commitment to seek your place in this progressive community enlarges our circle of compassion and brings gladness to all who share a vision of a world made better by collective action and gathering to celebrate the greatness of this life. Will you accept our gifts of fellowship, adventure, and service? Will you share with us your unique presence and gifts? Will you freely join the history of Unitarian Universalist women and men who spread hope with our living faith? Will you engage with us as we seek to create a community of compassion and reverence, a world dedicated to love and justice? If so, say we will. Or I will. Congregation, all those out there, will you open your lives to these new members with the kindness and comfort of your fellowship? Will you share your strengths and talents to support them as they share their gifts of insight and experience what they have to bring to us? Will you share our triumphs, their triumphs, our struggles, their struggles, as our community grows and changes? Let us welcome our new members with opening minds and hearts that celebrates the diversity among us, that promotes truth-seeking in every way, that helps liberate us all from oppression. Let us do it with love. Does everyone have a chalice to remind them of the light that shines here and when you need it to celebrate or to just reflect? All right. Thank you, Destiny and Nick. So let's give a warm welcome to everyone. All right. Thank you very much.
embrace me. You irreplaceable you. Just one look at you and my heart grew tipsy in me. You and you alone bring out the gypsy in me. I love all the many charms about you. Above all, I want my arms about you. Don't be so bashful, darling. Say you love me, say you love me, do. My sweet embraceable. Thank you.
the children up here? Great. Thank you, Kathleen. So, that was beautiful. I was thinking that I have known a lot of you kids for a lot of your lives, and I have never asked you this question, this kind of important question that lots of grown-ups like to ask, but I don't like to be a normal grown-up, but I'm going to do it now. So, what do you want to be when you grow up? Jocelyn, what do you want to be?
A vet.
She wants to be a vet. That's pretty awesome. You like animals? Cool. Berg, what do you want to be?
A soccer player.
A soccer player. You're going to be good at that. You already are. Nick, what do you want to be? An inventor. Awesome. Clara? What? Study birds. She wants to study birds. That's pretty cool. What do you want to be, Kaya? A hotel what? A hotel monitor. That sounds important. Rose? Something important. Rose is thinking about it. Does anybody... Oh, Destiny. Man. He wants to be a policeman. That's pretty important. What do you want? These two guys want to be firefighters. That's good. You can work together. That's pretty awesome. Does anybody, when I was little, people like to ask us if we wanted to be the president. Does anybody here want to be the president? You do? Awesome. Indigo, you want to be the president, maybe? Well, I noticed something, though. There's never been a girl president. Are you sure you could do it? Do you have to be a boy? You don't have to be a boy? No? That's a good point. I don't think you do. What about a teacher? Does anybody think being a teacher would be cool? Rose, that's what Rose wanted to say. Ronan, you'd be a good teacher. But wait a minute. Wait a minute. Can boys be teachers? Yes. Oh, Maeve's fifth grade. You know what? Awesome. So there are some boy teachers, and actually my favorite teacher ever was my fifth grade teacher who was a man. So, of course, you can be a teacher if you're a man. Miss Linda. I know Miss Linda. Burke. Someone at least. There's lots of boy teachers, right? And someday there's going to be a girl president, and there's lots of boy nurses and lots of things like that. So does it really matter if you're a boy or a girl when you decide what you want to be? No, not really. Not really. So I'm going to read you this book that my kids liked when they were a little bit smaller. It's called He Bear, She Bear. So it's kind of about that. So bear with me, bigger kids. This is a little rhymey. I see her, she sees me, we see that we are he and she. Every single bear we see is a he bear or a she. Every single bear we see has lots of things to do and be. I'm a father, I'm a he. A father's something you could be. I'm a mother, I'm a she. A mother's something you could be. Dad's a he, mom's a she. Those are things that we could be just because we're he and she. But there are other things to be. Come on, he bear, follow me. We could fix a clock, paint a door, build a house, have a store. Drive a dump truck, drive a crane, bulldoze roads, drive a train. There's the train. Is that what you want to do? We fix clocks, we paint doors, we build houses, we have stores, we bulldoze roads, we drive cranes, we drive trucks, we drive trains. We can do all these things, you see, whether we are he or she. We climb ladders to fix the wires, we climb ladders to put out fires. That's Officer Marguerite, she tells us when to cross the street. You could be a doctor, make folks well, teach kids how to add and spell. Knit a sock, sew a dress, paint a picture. What a mess. You like that one? You could lead a band, sing a song, play a tuba, beat a gong, play a banjo, plink a plink. You could even play on the kitchen sink. We have stores, we fix clocks, we are officers, we knit socks, we teach kids how to add and spell, we drive, we build, we make folks well, we climb ladders, we sew dresses, we make music, we make messes. We can do all these things, you see, whether we are he or she. What will we do, you and I? I'll tell you what I'm going to try. Now this is Sister Bear talking. I may build bridges, I may climb poles, I may race cars, I may dig holes. I could be a magician. I could go on TV. I could study the fish who live in the sea. Now here's Brother Bear. I'll be a cowboy. I'll go to the moon. I'll feed a whale. I'll train a baboon. We'll fly a giant jumbo jet. We'll build the tallest building yet. We will jump on a trampoline. We'll do tricks that have never been seen. We'll tame 12 tigers and 26 fleas. We'll do a dance on a flying trapeze. We'll jump and dig and build and fly. There's nothing that we cannot try. We can do all these things, you see, whether we are he or she. So many things to be and do. He bear, she bear, me and you. Thanks, guys.
Susan Adamczyk will present, is this on? Thank you. The Helping Hands Sunday for Peggy Bowman Fund. So let's welcome Susan. Thank you.
I'm going to try to speak spontaneously, but I get a little nervous doing this, so I did write some remarks out. I'd like to thank the Social Action Committee for your support of Peggy Bowman during the past several years, and welcome the opportunity to speak about this cause with you again today. Some of you may remember that I spoke here several years ago talking about the plight of women in Africa who are suffering the burden of HIV. I'd like to talk today about some women closer to home who are dealing with equally dire circumstances. There have been some big headlines about reproductive health issues in the last couple of weeks. I couldn't have set this talk up better. National focus on Planned Parenthood, questions about the commitment and integrity of the Susan G. Komen Foundation, lots of furor about contraceptive use in the past week. I think I have to thank all the major media outlets for getting us ready for this conversation. Today I'm here to ask you to once again support, and support generously, the Peggy Bowman Second Chance Fund. We're an entirely volunteer-run organization that provides financial support to poor women in need of an abortion. Last year, we had nearly 300 requests for support, and we gave some grants to 166 women. Now, we didn't turn anyone away. That discrepancy has to do with our bookkeeping system and when we record calls and when the checks go out. Some women, obviously, are able to eventually come up with the funds they need themselves or don't go to their appointment. There's about 100 abortion funds throughout the U.S. operating to provide this kind of support for women. And we are one of the very few that has never had to turn a woman away because we did not have resources. There are funds in other states that actually stop answering their phones midway through the month because they've run out of money. And thanks to the very generous support of you as individuals and as members of this community, we've never had to do that. That doesn't mean that providing these services is easy. I'm sure most of you are aware of the attacks on abortion providers and the difficulties that they are facing in part due to legislation which our state legislature is trying to enforce. We only have 3 abortion providers in the entire state of Kansas, and most of them, all of them, are east of here. The legislature has passed regulations that impose irrational and unnecessary requirements on these clinics. I'm not talking about requirements that would safeguard the health of women accessing these services. I'm talking about dictating the temperature of rooms, the square footage of broom closets, locker space for people, for the staff. Obviously, I'm sure you're aware that these are all being contested in the courts. However, this is taking important time, energy, and resources from what we need to be doing in terms of serving the women in need. Because there are so few providers in Kansas and none performing later term abortions, our fund has links with about 10 clinics as far away as Minnesota and New Mexico. While this ensures that the women who reach out to us are able to access services, obviously their procedures are not affordable, accessible, nor confidential. How does someone living in Smith Center, Kansas, say to their husband, their mother, their friend, "I'll see you in a couple of days, I'm going to Denver for an abortion"? It's not something they can do with any privacy whatsoever. As I was preparing for this talk, Betty and I reviewed some of the information that we keep about the women we serve. And I just passed out a few pieces of paper. Can I ask, maybe would you start and just read what's on the piece of paper for us?
Second Chance Fund after I became pregnant as a victim of incest.
I am 15 years old and my mom died last year. My grandparents are taking care of me and my 4 younger brothers and sisters. I have to go to New Mexico to have my abortion because I was too far along to have a procedure in Kansas. It is costing thousands of dollars. My grandparents are using all of their savings, $2,000, to pay for the drive there and our motel rooms.
I left my girlfriend when she got pregnant. Who needs to deal with a kid?
My wife and I are graduate students. We were happy to be pregnant, but learned there is something wrong with the baby. We have insurance, but it has a huge deductible.
My girlfriend is 23 and has 3 kids. I want to help, but I don't have any cash. At least I can drive her to the clinic for her appointments.
I'm 23 with 3 kids. My husband was deported, leaving us on our own. I had to take the bus from Garden City to Kansas City with the kids to get my procedure.
There's 1 or 2 more.
I am a 22-year-old student. I was raped. I don't have health insurance.
I am a soldier in Iraq trying to get home to my wife. She is pregnant with our 3rd wanted child, and we just learned the baby has a fetal anomaly.
So I think you get the picture. We hear this story over and over and over, 300 times last year. Obviously, these are people with severe problems. There are other cases of people who are on food stamps. They don't have electricity. You have extended families that are living together trying to eke out a day-to-day living. So please help us to help them.
Hi, good morning. Oh, can you hear me? Okay. My name is Katie Kingry Page, and as you probably noticed earlier, I'm a new member of the fellowship. My father and I joined a few months ago. I was really thrilled when Annelle and Michael asked me to share something today about equality and the vote. And as Susan just made us so aware of, we're living in an era where people have to refight battles that we thought were won in terms of civil rights. And I think that's true of all kinds of people, but certainly it hits home for me in terms of the battles with reproductive justice that women are continually having to refight. It's easy then in our times for us to forget the history of Kansas and Kansans, and the fact that we felt entitled to freedoms and rights. And so I wanted to share with you today an account from a relative of mine, from my great-great-aunt, Emily Jane Page Craig. And what I'm about to read to you is based upon stories told to my father when he was a boy by this great-aunt to him, her brothers, and other family members. The Naturalness of the Vote, an account from a typical Kansan, Emily Jane Page Craig. Mother brought us to Kansas in 1885. We came on the train with Mother and Mr. Blankenship, my three brothers and I. I was the baby, just 4 years old. Mr. Blankenship was my mother's second husband. She married him after my father, a Union veteran of the Civil War, died in our home state of Kentucky. Our neighbors and kin didn't like that my daddy fought in Abe Lincoln's army. Mother found herself widowed and alone, so she set out to seek a fresh start. She met Mr. Blankenship, also a Union veteran, in Indiana, married him, and we all came to Kansas. Wichita was a Union veterans town in the 1880s. If you were a Confederate, you kept your mouth shut. That's a quote from my dad. Mother and her new husband had an easy time. He found plenty of work in the booming economy. Their relationship was not so easy. Mr. Blankenship spent Mother's money too freely and enjoyed the vices of the day. One evening, Mother had Charlie, my big brother, talk with Mr. Blankenship. Accompanied by his pistol, Charlie convinced Blankenship to leave town. I'm happy to say I never saw him again. Not too much later, Mother married William Miller, another Union veteran from Michigan, and they lived happily until he passed. Mother got us through the economic downturn of the 1890s by giving piano lessons to the rich folks' children. We always had music in our house, good hymns and tunes to raise our spirits. Mother sent me to college at Friends University. I was the only girl in our family, but that didn't mean a thing. My brother Thomas told me I could do anything a man could do, and he believed Mother and I should be voting, just like the men. I knew he was right. The push for women's vote in Kansas began long before I was born. By 1861, Kansas women were part of a nationwide universal suffrage movement aimed at enfranchisement of blacks and women. Even in 1887, before women had the state vote, we won the right to vote in municipal elections, and a woman became mayor of Argonia, Kansas, and that was the first female mayor in the entire nation. Kansas women were not shrinking violets. We worked as hard as the men, we held our families together, and we deserved a voice in the affairs of state. I walked with my sisters in the Women's Christian Temperance Union, an alliance of more than 25,000 women across the nation, united for suffrage. We paraded in downtown Wichita, more in celebration than in agitation, because we knew the vote would pass for women, and it did. In 1912, a full 8 years before Congress ratified the 19th Amendment, giving all women the right to vote. As for me, I settled in my home neighborhood in North Wichita. I married Ernest Craig, a hard worker who owned businesses and built commercial properties in the North End. We raised three daughters, Frances, Evelyn, and Ernestine. We sent Frances to Columbia University, where she earned a master's degree. She lived and worked in Chicago tenements as a social worker. It broke our hearts when she took ill and died young. That was in the 1930s. Those years were hard on me. In the 1920s, my husband, Ernest, was drinking, smoking cigars. These Christian temperance ladies did not like any of this, right? And took up with another woman who let him smoke in her house. The good Lord doesn't condone wickedness in men. Why should I? I let him know he could take his vices elsewhere, and he did. I stayed in the old neighborhood, not far from my daughter Ernestine and her family. So that's about my great-great-aunt Emily Jane, who died in 1969 in the same city where she'd raised her family. My family lived in her house in the 70s when I was a little girl, and I grew up playing in her backyard and looking at the roses on the wallpaper when I fell asleep. And I have to say that in some degree, thanks to these stories about these Kansas women, I grew up never questioning my enfranchisement, my equality, my rights as an American. Thanks.
A woman's right. A woman's right. A woman's right. Women are right. That's according to Sybil, and I would suggest you obey. It was the people, not we, the white male citizens, nor yet we, the male citizens, but we, the whole people, who formed the Union. Susan B. Anthony, who grew up and was raised as a Quaker with lots of very progressive values, but those values did not allow her to move forward with her prime goal in life, which was to give women the right to vote. Her mural is in the sanctuary of the Unitarian Universalist Church in Rochester, New York. So there she is, as if it were Jesus standing before everyone saying, there should be equality for all. Margaret Fuller, who is one of the first Unitarians to become well known for women's rights, was a part of the Transcendental movement and who would spar with Ralph Waldo Emerson, who she thought was rather cold and intellectual and unfeeling. She was a woman of enormous talents and was known at an early age to be the best read person in New England. And she was the editor of The Dial, the Transcendental periodical, the first woman to be an editor of a major periodical in the United States. She was also hired as a reporter by Horace Greeley for the New York Tribune. And there she reported about things around the country. And when Civil War broke out in Italy, she went there and she found her true love at a later age. And they had a child. And she was known mostly, though, I guess, for the first important book on women's rights written in this country. It's a history of women's suffrage, women's rights. Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who did the most work to get the things rolling in terms of women's suffrage, said, Margaret Fuller possessed more influence on the thought of American women than any woman previous in her time. So you might wonder, how does love fit into this whole issue of equal rights? This is a Valentine's service. And how does it happen that we are lifting up today the need for continued attention to women's rights in this country and throughout the world? Michael Oldfather and I discussed this as he said, well, we're singing these songs. Do they fit this program? And I thought about it. I said, oh, they always work. And then I thought some more, and I thought, well, yes, of course they do work. Because you cannot have true love without true equality. If there is an imbalance in power in the relationship, the love is imbalanced. And we always know that there is an adjustment that is fluid and evolving. But we need to pay attention to how that balance is working in our lives as we move through our days and nights. Theodore Parker, who is most known as the preeminent person who spoke against slavery in the country, a Unitarian minister, who is absolutely vilified by all his colleagues, had the highest attendance of any church in the Boston area. But not only was he someone who advocated for the end of slavery, he was just as passionate about the rights of women and that they should have a voice in national politics. And this leads me to the name of the road that you all drove on to get here today, Zinedale, which was named by Hosiah Hobart Pillsbury. And he was a devotee of Theodore Parker. He moved here in the third immigrant wave of the New England Immigrant Aid Society to make sure that there would be no slavery in the state. But he and his wife, who settled above Pillsbury Crossing, were also a very, very powerful team. They held Unitarian services in their cabin. They had the first post office. They started the first school where girls and boys were welcome to learn about how they could become active in the world in a powerful way. And when all of that became too much, they decided to buy a paper in Manhattan, Kansas in 1863, and they renamed it the Independent. And Francis and Hosiah ran that paper with progressive values stamped on every single page. And among the most important of those progressive values were the rights of women. They were always being lifted up, as the rights of animals were being lifted up, as the rights of African Americans were being lifted up. He didn't separate them out thinking one cause was more important than the other. He saw that they were radically related and connected. That you can't have equality here and inequality over here. If you kick your dog and you don't feed your cows, if you don't give water to your horses, what kind of person are you? So these are the kinds of questions and issues that Hosiah and his dear, dear wife, Frances, lifted up. They worked tirelessly to promote progressive causes in Kansas. And when she died in 1867, Hosiah did not have the heart to continue alone in this venture. So there was a relationship of such deep love and deep commitment to doing good in the world. And without that deep love, that presence of it in his life, he didn't feel like he could go on doing that very important work that the Independent provided for citizens of Manhattan and the surrounding area. And I'd just like quickly to mention that it was the Universalists in Kansas who lifted up the rights of women more than Unitarians. There were four Universalist ministers who were women in Kansas in the 19th century. The first Universalist church in Lawrence was Sarah Barnes, and she was the minister there until her husband got well enough to take the position, but for a year, she was the person in charge. And then she went on to Seneca, she spoke in Junction City, but found that there wasn't really a church for her full time. And Hutchinson, Kansas, which started a Universalist church in 1872, ordained at least four women as ministers. So there was a real sense that if you are going to say God is love, if love is active as an agent in the world to produce good, then you can't separate men from women. What a powerful gift we are given today by that heritage.
Whoa. And I'm supposed to follow that? I would sort of like to talk a little bit about my family, my inheritance, and why I'm what I am today. My story, my grandmother, Desiree Daisy Stromstad, was the oldest of two sisters, born in 1873 in Indiana. Her younger sister was named, I can't even pronounce it, Euphrosyma? They're supposed to be names from the Bible. And we knew her as Aunt Sina, which was a lot easier to say. She later had a candy factory and a store in Homestead, Florida. She even sold her candies, fruit, and candies to the big exclusive store in New York City, Macy's. She was quite a businesswoman. This was Aunt Sina. Their parents, my great-grandparents, were Gustav Stromstad and Anna Catherine Enel. According to family stories, Stromstad goes way back to the Vikings. And the Enel family, according to my sister Jenny's recent research, goes back to the Samis. Most people know them by the name of Laplanders, but they prefer the name Samis. My grandmother moved with the family to Charleston, West Virginia, and the girls there learned to ride side saddle played the piano, and were active in the Baptist Church. Daisy, in her early 20s, went to Alaska to tutor the governor's Brady's children. And while there, she persuaded the governor to allow her to go to the island of Triticale, where no white woman had ever been, and she taught the Inuit children there. In many of my boxes of pictures, I have pictures of her classroom with the fire in the center and the hole in the ceiling for the smoke to escape. Later, she traveled taking pictures and gathering all kinds of Alaskan art and craft with the idea of lecturing on the subject, which she did successfully. She married Marion Thomas Brown, an Easterner prospecting for gold in Alaska. They lived in Nome until she decided to go back to Charleston, West Virginia, where the little girl, my mother, was born on the 3rd of February, 1909. She was named Marie Enel Brown. Daisy, in 1912, along with four other members of her Bible study group, founded the YWCA in Charleston, West Virginia, for women, so that women had a place to stay while they were working. She moved to Cincinnati with her daughter when she got interested in education. Her husband died in Alaska before he could join them. All these papers. Daisy got her Bachelor of Science in Education from the Columbia University, where she studied under the philosopher John Dewey, which many of you in education would recognize the name, and the psychologist Edward L. Thorndike. Both men had very different ideas about education in those days. And John Dewey, of course, supported woman suffrage. She later got her Master of Art degree in education from the University of Cincinnati. An accomplished organ and piano player, she accompanied many of the artists of the day. And she taught during her school year and then traveled in the summer, showing her slides and crafts from Alaska. She had very many interesting ideas in education. In 1921, she set up a class for the University of Cincinnati students. She got rid of the desk and had three round tables. She taught math by having a store and having the students do the arithmetic, the bookkeeping, the percentages, and interest rates. And the students learned geography, reading, writing, by means of reports that the children would write on things that they were interested in. She also worked with discipline problem children and was able to get them to work like little beavers. She had problems with the school board, who were sure her ideas were all nonsense. She was in the process of writing a thesis on her educational ideas when she was diagnosed with cancer. And an adventurous, creative woman died in December of 1929, before I was born. My great-grandfather died in 1935. As you can see, I come from a long line of strong women. One day, Byrne came back. He always spoke to any group who would ask him to speak. And he came back one night after speaking to a garden club group in Troy, New York, and said, "You ought to join the League of Women Voters." And he had met Edith Ware, a staunch League member, who talked his ear off about the League. Edith became one of my best friends and mentors in League. I had two boys, one a 5.5-year-old and an 18-month-old, and we lived in the country 10 miles from Troy. But he insisted. So in the spring of 1961, I joined the League of Women Voters of Rensselaer County and immediately became involved in the study of Latin America we were doing at the time. The next year, I was talked into becoming president. My experiences at the first conference of the League of Women Voters of the United States, when it was in Philadelphia, was when President Johnson, at the end of our conference, insisted on coming to talk to us because of our newly elected study of public housing. So you can imagine what happens when a president comes. Everything is shut down and you can't leave for 2 hours before or 2 hours after, so it was quite an experience. Then, of course, I spent the next couple of years, 65 to 71, on the League of Women Voters in New York State Board, organizing leagues up and down from Westchester County up to Plattsburgh and the Canadian border. In 71, we moved to Kansas. I transferred my membership to the League of Women Voters of Manhattan-Raleigh County, and I have served on the league board, state league board, organizing leagues in Kansas. And this is a great way to get to know the state. I also organized the first state conference on energy at Kansas State in 1975. And then a few years later, we had an energy conference in Topeka. In 73, while a delegate to the National Convention, the delegates voted full voting privileges for Mayan and League of Women Voters. The only problem was that Byrne and John Chalmers always argued who was the first one to sign up in the League of Women Voters of Rensselaer County. And I don't know who won the battle, but they always had that discussion. Byrne also became the first male and only one so far to be president of the League of Women Voters of Manhattan Raleigh County in 1971 to 93. He also served on the League State Board from 94 to 96. On the celebration of Valentine's Day, I can say that Byrne and I shared many wonderful times and were on the front lines of many battles in many communities in New York and Kansas. Some we lost, some we won. We shared a wonderful life of mutual respect, love, and equality in our partnership. And I will give you his challenge. On the eve of the League of Women Voters' 92nd birthday, February 14th, 1919. And I have been a member, I guess, for 51 years now, I just suddenly realized. It seems today that many legislators and governors that are trying to take away not only our right to health care, equal rights in the workplace, but our right to vote. This battle started back in Florida before the infamous Gore-Bush election debacle and continues today in states all over the country. We have a lot of work to do to protect our democracy and return the power to all people. The thing that Byrne always said, until we have full equality, we cannot have full love and understanding among all people. In extinguishing the challenge today, this flame would continue somewhere else. No? You want something? Okay. We're working together here.
Yes, we are. Thank you. Well, since it's been such a full morning, we will not review the contributions of Margaret Sanger, who is the founder in some ways of Planned Parenthood, and who did so much to help women gain reproductive knowledge so that they could take control of when and how they got pregnant. And this comes from being in a situation where her mother had 8 children but had conceived 18 times, and she died from being pregnant so often. So anyway, just to keep her in mind as we lift up the rights of women. But I feel like it's really important to bring all this together, not just as a kind of chronology and history and a need for a deeper democracy in our country, but how do we live this in our daily lives as people who are Unitarian Universalists? And I would like to quickly share a dream that woke me up with its power. I'm just standing at some conference, and I don't know where, and this woman who is about my age or maybe a little older comes up to me, very self-assured, and she takes my arms and lifts them up, and then she presses herself up against me and begins to dance, and I'm thinking, what's going on here? And then she keeps on looking into my eyes in such a way that I know that she's teaching me something. And what I begin to feel is that my feet are deeply rooted in the earth, that with each move and with each touch, as she teaches me how to dance, I become as feminine as she becomes masculine, and masculine as she becomes feminine. So there's this beautiful balancing that's happening in my body as I feel the full power of my being being lifted up by this incredible knowledge of this woman, not through words, but through touch. And in the next scene, we find ourselves, I'm in this room and I don't know where I am, and there are all these kids and they're going like this, and they're dancing and they're happy and they're rejoicing, and there's one in the center who is a golden African American boy with reddish gold and brown dreadlocks, a perfect kind of mirror of the sun. And he looks at me with steady concentration and he says, "Dance, dance, dance." So we start dancing and everyone in the room is just dancing with all these kids. And as I look around, there are kids from all over the world teaching me how to dance. And then we're in this huge, monumental stone building. And I'm wondering, where are we? And I'm looking around and there are people of every color, of every age, of every sect, of every gender persuasion around me. And I think, what is this about? And then it comes to me as someone lifts their head up and they just start singing. And they are singing from the bottom of their toes to the top of their head. And we're singing together humanity. We're singing out of a place of equality. We're singing humanity together as if the song were a thread that connected all of us in a way that was so powerful, so filled with love, that you couldn't resist but lift yourself up and be a part of that great music of humanity. And I woke up and I was just shuddering with just this incredible joy. And the joy comes from realizing that we need to bring together man and woman inside each of us so that we can greet each person with equality, with respect, with dignity, and a sense of deep love. It's not always possible, but it is possible if you dream. And as a community, that dream can grow and reach and lift up so many people, those 25 to 30% of the children in this country who live in poverty need our love. Let us unite.
In extinguishing the chalice today, this flame continues somewhere else. Parts of Byrne's pledge given for his students should give us thought for our lives and actions. Quote, "We will recognize our work as part of the larger whole. We will respect the past, local traditions, and regional differences. We will try to avoid conflicts of interest and be open about them when they arise. We will be honorable in our dealings, seek fair compensation for what we do, and give to those who render us service. We will be demanding of ourselves and realistic in our expectations of others. And finally, we will seek the courage to be vulnerable and to care.